name of the picture. Anatomy lesson of Dr. Culp. Is it really an anatomy lesson? No, it's not really an anatomy lesson. It's actually a group of surgeons who had a guild, sort of like the American College of Surgeons, maybe it was the Dutch College of Cutters, and they got together. He was their most distinguished. That's why he's doing the so-called dissection, and those are his colleagues who are not really his students. It was just a way Rembrandt memorialized this group of skilled surgeons. For those of you who will be taking the suture course with us later in the spring, I point out to you that in the 450 years since the picture was taken, we still hold the instruments the same way, with the thumb and the fourth finger. And if you hold it with the thumb and the index finger, as many people start to do, I will remind you that that's the technique for cutting which you learned in kindergarten. Okay. Now, here in the U.S., 20 or more years, 200 or more years later, we had some pretty good surgical teaching paintings. And they're from, you know, last time I mentioned to you that there's some story going around that Columbia is the oldest school. No, it's Pennsylvania. Well, you know the story. Columbia gave the degree, but Pennsylvania was started first. Now, here in a 15-year period, what differences do we see in the practice of surgery? This is the Gross Clinic, and it is pretty gross because if you look in there, the mother has a horrified look as her son is being operated upon, and they're all in street clothes. Within 15 years, we had the understanding, the beginning understanding of asepsis, and people started washing their hands and wearing special clothes when they went to the operating room. And very importantly, there was anesthesia being delivered here, but it was better by the 15 years later. And then with the understanding of asepsis and with anesthesia, surgery could go forward. And with the advances in surgery, we also had many advances in anatomy, because certain things that didn't seem significant before suddenly became very significant. We're going to point out, though, that Eakins in his lecture had some of the problems that even developed to this day. If you look very carefully under the check, you'll notice that one of the students is sleeping. Now, the story is that this portrait of Eakins that Eakins painted was paid for by the students as a tribute to Agnew. This is the Agnew Clinic, and he is the surgeon contemplating the operation as it's proceeding by his assistants. And the story is that they all paid up except this guy. So he may not have been sleeping, but he got even with him for not paying up by painting him that way. But from my own observations, there are a couple of people here who are at risk for being painted that way, paid up or not. Okay. The area of clinical correlation that I'm going to talk about today is one that's a novel concept. Probably we all grew up, or you all grew up, with the knowledge that we had arteries and veins, and that arteries took blood to organs and veins took it away. We didn't have to learn to accept the concept of the circulation. Harvey, some 400 or 500 or 600 years ago, developed the concept of the circulation. It used to be thought that blood started in the heart or the liver and then went out from there and never quite came back. But the idea of a closed circulatory system was well established, and we grew up accepting that, just like we accept gravity. For years, I thought that people ought to be falling off the earth when it's down in China and they're upside down. And it still doesn't quite make me comfortable, even though I've traveled all around the earth. And I always do look to see the swirl in the toilet bowl or the sink to see if it's the wrong way down below the equator. But, you know, we accept certain things as fact. And here we're going to accept as a fact that we can have a circulatory system where we have arteries feeding a structure, but also veins. Now, for an artery to pump blood to an organ, that's easy to accept. Arteries have nice, strong... Arteries have nice, strong... Thunderstorm. Okay, arteries have nicely maintained pressure. By the way, how big is blood pressure? Do any of you know how much blood pressure you have? Can somebody show me with your hand how much blood pressure you have? Someone over here said about this much, and someone else said this much. Okay, if you've been in an old-time doctor's office and you see the mercury manometer on the wall, you know, where he pumps up and looks at the mercury, we don't do that. We have it all digital now. But it would say 120, and then it would fluctuate, go down to 80. That would be 120 millimeters of mercury. Well, we don't think in terms of millimeters of mercury. But we do think in terms of inches of water. And our blood pressure is about 70, 80 inches of water, which makes sense because if it's going to pump from the heart, it's got to go to the head and it's got to go to your feet and it has to overcome vascular resistance. So a blood pressure of around 120, 130, 140 is plenty to get blood to all the organs. And then we're telling you suddenly that veins can get blood to an organ. That's sort of counterintuitive because the blood pressure in veins is much lower than in arteries. And as you get a little bit, I understand you had a physiology lecture. I don't know if you've had the physiology of the right ventricle, but I think you saw in the lab that the right ventricle is much thinner than the in thickness than the left ventricle. And the right ventricle only pumps at around 20 to 30 millimeters of pressure, the left ventricle at 120, 130. The reason that the organs perfuse is that they have very good compliance. The lung is a highly compliant organ, so you can perfuse it with a relatively low pressure. Somehow, we've got to accept the fact that the portal vein can still perfuse the liver, even though it's under relatively low pressure, the pressure of the venous system. So where does the blood come into the portal system? What's it doing there? Well, we oversupply the stomach, the small bowel, and the colon with blood supply. You saw the bowel, it's thin, it doesn't have much metabolic need. The blood's going to those intestinal organs to pick up stuff, not to deliver oxygen. So there's little oxygen extraction from the blood. Now, I'm not sure about this, but I think most of you believe in intelligent design, or is this an evolution crowd? Okay, either way, there must be a reason for the excess blood supply, and the blood goes to the liver for metabolic activity, and that metabolic activity requires oxygen. So by the time the blood leaves the liver, the appropriate oxygen has been extracted from both the hepatic artery and the portal venous blood. And then here's something that isn't quite anatomic but important to know. The hepatic artery, the proper hepatic from the celiac, and we know that about 15% of people in whom the right hepatic, there are 15% of people in whom the right hepatic artery comes from the SMA. It doesn't come from the celiac. We also know that there's the portal vein supplying it, and virtually everybody has a portal vein. But where's the liver really getting its oxygen from? The hepatic artery or from the portal vein? So hepatic artery carries 20 cc's of oxygen per 100 cc's. We call that volumes percent. Portal venous blood has only, 20 cc's. That should be 17 and a half, not 85. That's 17 and a half. I'll change it right now. 17 and a half cc's of oxygen per 100 cc's. But the hepatic vein has only 15 cc's of oxygen per 100 cc's. So the arterial blood carries a lot of oxygen, the portal venous blood somewhat less, and by the time the blood leaves the liver, it's down to only 15 cc's. So what's the extraction ratio in the liver? What percentage of all the supplied oxygen gets taken out by the metabolic activity in the liver? Overall, in the human body, it's about 25%. And that's about what it is overall in the liver. And what percentage of this blood came from the hepatic artery and the portal vein? And that's actually a mixture problem from freshman algebra, or if you went to a good school, maybe 7th or 8th grade algebra. Half the oxygen comes from the hepatic artery, half came from the portal vein. The arterial blood is at higher pressure, the portal vein is at much lower pressure, and the hepatic vein blood is at the least pressure. So that's why things flow through the liver. And let's talk about the guy who drank too much and got cirrhosis. Now, the word cirrhosis means scarring. Or maybe somebody who was unfortunate enough to contract hepatitis with ongoing inflammation. And when we talk about hepatitis with ongoing inflammation, we're not talking about hepatitis A. That's an inflammatory hepatitis caused by a virus. Caused by a virus. And it's the kind that's from poor hygiene. It's not the blood-transmitted hepatitis B or hepatitis C. The hepatitis that gives ongoing inflammation is hepatitis B and C. And with ongoing inflammation in the liver, we get destruction of cells, regeneration of cells, and with scarring in the liver, destruction and regeneration, we get nodules that grow within the liver, and these nodules compress the portal vein branches within the liver so that the portal blood cannot flow through the liver easily. And someone who has cirrhosis from drinking, perhaps, or from ongoing hepatitis with destruction regeneration, these are people at risk for portal hypertension. So we'll talk about our patient, who is a 46-year-old man with a history of both alcohol abuse and hepatitis B, who enters with repeated bouts of right upper quadrant abdominal pain, precipitated initially, he said, only after a fatty meal. And we know that fatty foods cause the release of CCK, cholecystokinin, and that causes contraction of the gallbladder. And if you're unfortunate enough to have stones within the gallbladder, it can squeeze on them and hurt, or the stones can block the cystic duct, in which case you're squeezing against a closed circuit, or even worse yet, stones can go, small ones can go through the cystic duct. They'll then enter the common bile duct, not the common hepatic duct, that's north, they'll enter the common bile duct, and they may lodge down near the sphincter of Oddi and block the common bile duct. And that gives pain that now goes from the right upper quadrant, if it's just the gallbladder that's blocked, to right the middle of the belly, and it may even drive through to the back. So this guy was pretty sick when he went to see his doctor, returned bouts of pain. And this is a somewhat exaggerated view of what he looked like. Now, most of our patients don't come in with their portal vein outlined on their belly. But you might look at him and say, gee, he doesn't look so neat. He's got some gynecomastia in spite of the fact that he's kind of thin. And the reason for that is the disease, the damaged liver, can't detoxify estrogens. So the patient gets gynecomastia. And if this weren't hidden in the Netherlands of the shadow, it would have shown small testicles because of the excess estrogen. If you look at his arms, he doesn't look particularly Charles Atlas-like, because, in fact, there's muscle wasting with cirrhosis. And this is to show you the portal vein, and I'm sure you all know what this is. Splenic vein going up to the spleen, and this is the... And as we've discussed, the inferior mesenteric vein has no business draining the lowest part of the intestine and dumping in to the portal system, in many cases, north of the superior mesenteric. It's sort of counterintuitive, And anything that's counterintuitive is pretty good to show up on exams. So you have to remember that this doesn't quite make sense. It doesn't follow the inferior mesenteric artery, whereas the veins over here follow the accompanying artery. So this is a good vein to remember about, the inferior mesenteric vein. But forgetting that, we all know this guy down here, don't we? Whose head is this? Medusa. And it's actually a rather exaggerated drawing. We'll see what his belly really looked like later. Okay, so our diagnosis was that this fellow had an acute gallbladder condition and that he might have stones obstructing his cystic duct or his common duct. And we thought on the basis of his physical that he had probable portal hypertension and cirrhosis. He also had what's called spider angiomata. He had gynecomastia, small testes. He had the caput medusae. And we have a pretty good knowledge of what he has. So we'll get a few confirmatory blood tests, check to see if he's actively inflamed, some liver tests. And the reason we do blood clotting studies is the liver makes the clotting factors for what's called the extrinsic system, which we measure by measuring the prothrombin time or the INR. And somebody with liver disease has blood that won't clot well because the synthetic function of the liver is impaired when they have cirrhosis. So we not only have to worry about their liver function test, but also that their blood will clot properly. And we're going to come back to that. It's going to become a recurring theme. So we now have blood studies that confirm what we think is going on. We have a physical exam. So we do want some anatomic confirmation, so we'll do a sonogram of his gallbladder, of his liver, and of his bile duct. Now, some years ago, before we had sonography, we would have done plain x-rays. And plain x-rays are not too helpful for liver pathology. Only 15% of gallbladders with stones will show the stones on a plain film. And I think I told you everything in medicine is 15 or 85%. I told you that. Yeah, the only thing you have to know is it 15 or 85. I think I also told you everything that I say is 15 or 85% true. Up to you to determine. Okay, so we're not going to do a plain film. We're going to do a sonogram. And this is what we're looking for, stones in the gallbladder, or maybe they've gone down the cystic duct into the common bile duct, and maybe they're lodged distally in the common bile duct, which dumps into the duodenum through the sphincter of Oddi. With the sonogram, we can actually see, if we position the probe correctly, the fluid shows up as black on a sonogram. It's anechoic without echoes. We can see the fluid in the gallbladder and a couple of white stones. And here's a view where we actually are seeing the common duct. By the way, the patients don't come labeled like this. We have to figure out what they are, and you add the labels later. So we've got a view with the common duct, and we see a white structure again. Now, it isn't only that they're white. If you look carefully, you'll see that after the white, the probe is up here, there's what we call a shadow. See the black lines coming down? So, this is characteristic for a stone in the gallbladder. It's hyperechoic, too many echoes, and it casts a shadow. And this is a stone in the bile duct. Here's another view of the gallbladder alone. And we see the shadows. And here we see a structure that's black. Anybody want to take a guess at what that might be? If we had a cross-section of the body, white might, what big black thing, meaning black is fluid-filled, might this be? I don't continue until somebody ventures a guess. Louder. Well, it's a blood vessel. What blood vessel would be this big? Portal vein. Exactly. Here we weren't looking at the portal vein. We weren't looking forward for it, but it is the portal vein. And this is a view taken at right angles to this. We're not seeing the common duct particularly well, But we do know that the common duct wall shows up, and just as we know that the common duct is just in front of the portal vein, we can infer that this is the common duct in front of the portal vein. So we can get to see a lot when we think of our anatomy as it's applied to sonography. Now, this guy has stones both in his gallbladder and in his common duct. 30, 20, 15 years ago, that meant we would have to do an open operation because we would have to take out his gallbladder over here, and we'd have to open up his bile duct and fish these out. But in the past 20 years, we've developed techniques called endoscopy, in which tubes can be passed down the mouth, through the esophagus, into the stomach, into the duodenum, and then we look for the ampulla ovata, the opening of the common bile duct and the pancreatic duct, into the duodenum, and we can actually put up balloons, catheters with balloons, push past the stone, blow up the balloon, and pull the stone down and through. So we can relieve him of his common duct obstruction, which might make him feel better transiently, but we'd be sitting on a powder keg because the next stones might then pass through, and each time the stones pass through, not only is it painful, but it could block the pancreas duct as well, and you could get pancreatitis, which can become a fatal disease. So after we clear out the stones from the common duct, we want to go ahead and take out his gallbladder. And I guess most of you know, and probably some of you have had relatives who have had gallbladders removed through laparoscopy. And that indeed is what we're going to do. And, whoops, go back. I am going to try to get this to open. Oh. Can you help me back there? It opened before. Can you get it to open again? No, it's going forward instead of opening. We have to go to the other screen. Okay, YouTube, yeah, it is. There we go. Thank you, right. Great. Okay. Now, for those of you who use YouTube for other purposes, here we are with our images through the camera inserted just below the belly button, or through the belly button, and we're grabbing the gallbladder here and pulling it up. By the way, this video was made by one of our former fellows in minimally invasive surgery. Now you're seeing the gallbladder, and I'm pointing out that these veins are prominent. I want you to pay attention to the veins of the gallbladder because we're going to talk about that. Now he's poking around. Where's he going down here? Whose triangle? Callot. Okay, the cholecystohepatic triangle, or the triangle of Callot. Bottom edge of the liver, common bile duct, and cystic duct. He's cauterizing a little bit so that he can dissect down and show us Callot's triangle. Here he's pushing the gallbladder towards the left, so we're clearing up the patient's right side of the back of the triangle of Callot. Then in a bit, he's going to pull it over to the right side, and notice he's cauterized through one of these little surface veins. Okay, now we have the cystic duct and the edge of the liver. We're going to soon see it further developed, and this is going to become obvious as the cystic duct. And what structure is going to be right in here? I'm waiting. I'm going to take my pictures away unless someone tells me what it is. Cystic artery lives in here, and the right hepatic artery. Okay, now we're going to develop it further, and at some point, we're going to have to control this artery, that is, stop the blood flow, and we're going to do that with clips. But before that, we're going to better develop the views, and here we're poking into the belly, something we didn't talk about yet. We're poking in a device that's going to help us guide a catheter into his cystic duct. We've clipped the cystic duct near the gallbladder. Here's the clip near the gallbladder. We've made a little cut in it right here. And there comes the bile dripping out. And down here is the cystic duct going into the common duct. And we're going to put a catheter in, because although we did a cholangiogram the day before, we want to make sure that more stones didn't drop down while waiting to go to the operating room. So now we're going to put this catheter into the cystic duct and put a little hold on it, and we're going to inject some x-ray dye, and we're going to get a picture called the cholangiogram presently. And it shows us the catheter cystic duct going into the common duct, common hepatic duct, and the intrahepatic radicals, and we don't see any remaining stones. So now we can go ahead and divide the duct after we've put on more clips. By the way, notice how this clip wasn't all the way across, so he's leaking some bile. So we have to pay attention to that if it was staying in the patient, but that's going to be coming out, as you'll see. Now we've divided the cystic duct, so we can go after the remaining cystic artery. We're going to clean it up, put a couple of clips on it, divide it. Now, every structure in the body that gets blood has arteries taking it to it and veins taking the blood away. And if it's an organ that has ducts, you got to divide the ducts. Well, here, all we've done so far is divide the arteries. What are we going to do about the veins draining the blood from the gallbladder? Well, the dissection is continuing with this little hook device, which is cauterizing these veins. And it's lifting the gallbladder off the bed of the liver. And remember that the gallbladder is in Cantrell's line, and that is the division between right and left lobes physiologically. By the way, the gallbladder is out. It went into a bag. And that's pulled out. Now we're washing out the belly, and now you're going to see where the gallbladder came from. There you go. This is the bed of the gallbladder. Clips on the cystic duct, clips on the cystic artery, and the operation is done. And I am done with this, so now I have to get us back into the slide sequence. So I close this and that, and we go to our next slide. So what about our guy? Now, if you could see this well enough, this is a moralistic, this is the guy's upright young man, then he starts drinking a little bit, then he carouses, then he drinks a lot more, gets cirrhosis, and becomes a drunken bum. And here he is, he is not yet completely out of it, he's just busy maintaining his cirrhosis, and he picked up hepatitis B when he was carousing around with some unsavory people and sharing needles. So he's got some big time trouble with his, so here he is now. He's got cirrhosis of the liver. Cirrhosis, diagrammatically shown here, is scarring, regeneration. And here it looks more like smallpox, but it's supposed to represent the regenerating nodules in the liver. By the way, what's this? What lobe is this? No, it's the lateral portion of the left lobe. The left lobe begins here at the gallbladder. This has two segments. This has two more, the quadrate and the caudate. Those are all anatomically left lobes. This is lateral portion of the left lobe. Okay, now, here he is on the table. He doesn't look as healthy as he did in his picture, does he? And Medusa's head, the caput medusae, isn't quite as florid as you might have wanted. But where is the blood going that's in these veins? Where did it come from? And where is it going? Oh, I'll give you a leg up then. Okay. This blood is coming from the portal system. the portal blood flow is under such high pressure that it's going through collaterals. Any of you read ahead for your lectures? Okay, this is the collaterals that it's going through. So it's going backwards through the falciform ligament. It's recanalizing the path of the umbilical vein. Remember the umbilical vein connected to the left portal vein, and then it dumped the blood through the ductus venosus into the left hepatic vein, and then it went back to the vena cava, into the heart, and then it was shunted across because the mother had done all the liver work and the lung work for the kid. So this blood then shunts across the foramen ovale down the right left ventricle, left atrium, left ventricle, and goes to the head where the kid needs the good blood. But now things are backing up, and it's recanalized, and blood is backing up from that left portal vein through the falciform ligament, going to the umbilicus, and it's shooting up through these surface veins to join the intercostals and the azygos and the hemiazygos in the superior vena cava, bypassing the liver to get back to the heart. So that's what it sort of looks like. And now we're going to discuss the venous drainage of the gallbladder. And I said, just as things that are counterintuitive are questioned, well, so are things that are wrong in the book. Now, you already know that Netter has a few mistakes. Anybody know what book this is from? Gray's Anatomy. And in Gray's Anatomy, they've carefully drawn in the mythical cystic veins. There ain't no cystic veins. Either that or every one of you missed them in your dissection. We know all the branches of the portal system, and I told you that frequently we don't even see the left and right gastric coming off the main portal vein. And certainly none of us saw the cystic veins. They don't exist, other than in Gray's Anatomy. But that's okay. We're tough. So, what are we going to do? We have a high-pressure vein. There are veins of the gallbladder. And if we did our laparoscopic cholecystectomy, as we usually do, what would happen? We'd cauterize all these dilated veins on the surface of the gallbladder, and they'll ooze and ooze and ooze. And the patient will bleed and bleed and bleed. And he'll ooze not only because of the high pressure in them, but also, remember, the liver makes the clotting factors, and with cirrhosis, he's defective in making his clotting factors. So, we never saw a cystic vein, and this patient has high pressure. What are we going to do so we can safely take out his gallbladder and not have him bleed and bleed? Well, what is the venous drainage of the gallbladder? For that, you have to go back to anatomy, and maybe you haven't had this as yet, but you do know that the pancreas has a dorsal and a ventral part. The ventral part is what gives rise to the liver bud, the gallbladder, and it comes off the duodenum. So since its origin is from the region of the duodenum, it will have the same venous drainage, namely into the portal system. But how is it going to get there if there's no cystic vein? Well, it gets there through the bed of the liver. All those little vessels in the wall of the gallbladder connect deeper to the portal veins within the liver. So when we do a cholecystectomy in somebody who has portal hypertension, we don't take the whole gallbladder out the way it was shown in that video. We leave the back wall attached to the undersurface of the liver. And we cut, leaving a cuff. And then we take stitches and we do what we call oversew the edge. And you might call this like a hem or a whip stitch. And we just make a hemostatic stitch. We alter our technique because we know that those blood vessels on the edge of the liver are under high pressure because they come from the portal system. They don't drain into the hepatic venous system. And if we didn't do this, laparoscopic cholecystectomy would be dangerous in cirrhotics and people with portal hypertension. And that ends the correlation that I wanted to discuss. It brought together all of the things that we have seen up in the lab. I just want to mention a couple of other things, and we're going to go to the picture of the, well, we already discussed this, that the inferior mesenteric vein doesn't follow an artery, important feature. Let's take a look at this, which was the typical picture of a cholangiogram. Here. This is so logical. The gallbladder is off to the right, and it's joining the common duct. It just is so logical that it's always drawn this way, and it almost never occurs this way. In fact, the cystic duct typically runs within the wall of the common duct and dumps in on the left side. An interesting feature, which is of importance when we do a cholangiogram, and I'm not going to run the film again, but when you do a cholangiogram, you can sometimes see that, and it makes a difference when we're operating that it isn't the way the diagrams show it. The other thing that's important is a little bit of physiology, and if you draw blood from somebody's arm, we said 25% of the oxygen is extracted. So the oxygen content, which should be 20 volumes per cent, 20 cc's of oxygen per 100 cc's of blood, it should be down to 15 volumes per cent, which would be 75% saturated. If you drew blood out of one of these little fellows, what would you think its color would be compared to standard venous blood, and what would its oxygen content be? Color would be darker or redder? Redder, and its oxygen content would be higher. And indeed that's true, because this is portal venous blood that hasn't perfused the liver, that is seeking a way back to the heart, so that it's carrying too much oxygen and the liver isn't getting the benefit of its nourishment. So the heart is getting strained, pumping blood for no purpose, and cirrhotics end up with higher cardiac outputs than normal because they're shunting, they're wasting circulation. And there's one final thing, and that is, if we wanted to correct this high blood pressure in the portal venous system, we could take the blood in the portal vein. Now, you remember where the portal vein is. It's pretty big. It's right in front of the foramen of Winslow. We didn't spend much time putting our fingers backwards, but if you did, what's that big vein that's right there? It also goes right up to the liver. It goes through the back of the liver. We had the big portal vein going into the liver, but what's the vein that goes through the liver? Inferior vena cava. If we join the portal vein to the inferior vena cava, we can decompress the high pressure in the portal system, and all the collaterals will dry up. But what happens metabolically to the patient? His blood is bypassing the liver, and they may get what we call hepatic encephalopathy, and they have metabolic complications of it, but it does stop bleeding from the caput medusae, which could rupture, or the esophageal varices, or any of the other collateral routes that have developed. So the liver and the portal circulation are somewhat of a new concept. There is one other portal system in the body. Does anybody have any idea of where that is? Exactly. I saw somebody back there. Do you have a particularly active hypothalamus, or you've read ahead? Ah. And liking endocrinology, you know that our pituitary circulation has a portal system where blood goes to an organ, leaves it, still rich in oxygen, and perfuses the second organ. And the pituitary has just such a portal system. Those are, I believe, the only two portions of the body that have such a portal system. Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
When you're doing the cholecystectomy for someone with that, with portal hypertension, and you're going to leave for the superior border of the gallbladder,
the back, the superior,
the,
yeah.
Do you go in and drain the gallbladder?